Hello, I'm Steve Rohr. This is number 0876, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0876. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Bart King is the author of Father Humor, Mastering the Art of the Dad Joke. Just because they're called dad jokes doesn't mean that the humor is gender specific.
My father, on the other hand, was very much what we would think of as a dad joker now. And so his influence on me, I think, would be, it was a gender normative situation in this sense, and that they're called dad jokes. By the way, which I should just say, because I haven't, I encourage anyone and everyone to make dad jokes regardless of their gender identity, their age, their family circumstances. You know, it's all to the good. None of that matters. This is just sort of like branding happened with it. Right? It happened in 1987 and it's stuck. Moms are delivering fresh chuckles every day.
Seth Panich is the author of the novel Antique. There is a very interesting twist that involves the hidden powers of the female protagonist.
She finds in one of these minor league antiques roadshow this old beaten up necklace. And what she finds is when she wears it, she can't tell people that grandma's ring is only worth $50. She starts overvaluing things. And what she finds is when, instead of getting fired, when these people go to auctions, it sells for exactly the amount she says it should. So she finds herself with the power to set the price of things based on the connection that the person has with it, not what the market says, and that puts her back on track to find her holy grail, something she's been looking for her whole life, and face the ultimate question, which is, what is she worth?
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. Book Banter sails along stormy Lake Superior to relive the legend of the Edmund Fitzgerald with The Gales of November. So batten down those hatches. It's going to be a stormy voyage later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, dad joke theater, Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0876, was Steve Rohr, a PR and communications specialist who has been very instrumental from the beginning of the Stuff File program and beyond in helping to secure great guests for this program. Thank you very much, Steve, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Let's see how many ways a guy can have a bad day. A 37-year-old St. Paul, Minnesota man faces charges after a toddler pulled a loaded handgun from a diaper bag during a traffic stop. Police initially stopped the man for not wearing a seatbelt. Officers discovered he lacked a driver's license and had outstanding warrants. Three children under the age of 3 sat in the back seat when one child climbed into the diaper bag to get tissues for a crying sibling. They emerged holding a gun. The officer instructed the child to put the weapon down and recovered it safely. The firearm contained 6 rounds in its magazine, but none in the chamber. The man told police he carried the gun for protection due to death threats and placed it near the diaper bag when pulled over. He faces gross misdemeanor charges for child endangerment by firearm access and carrying a pistol without a permit. Bail was set at $5,000. So, is he a candidate for Father of the Year? Oh, so sorry. And we don't have any parting gifts either. According to a lawsuit, Joshua Smiley has no connection to Kathy George, And as far as the plaintiff's lawyers know, he has no connection to the state of Georgia. Nevertheless, the U.S. Marshals Service and the DeKalb County, Georgia Sheriff's Office went looking for him in George's condo in Fulton County, and they went in force. What looks on video like 15 or more armed agents burst into her apartment at night after breaking through her front door. And where was Smiley? The suspect, who was on a most wanted list, was already behind bars. The Marshals Service had announced his arrest months earlier. The Institute for Justice is helping George sue the agencies. According to her lawyers, there is a process called deconflictation that's supposed to prevent mistaken operations like the raid on her home. You know, I don't know. Here's an idea. How about taking people off the most wanted list once you have them? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a woman suffered minor arm injuries after a dog accidentally discharged a shotgun at a Scotts Bluff, Nebraska convenience store. Police responded to reports of gunfire in the parking lot, discovering a truck with door damage and a female bystander struck by shotgun pellets. Investigation revealed the vehicle owner had left a loaded shotgun in the back seat while shopping inside the store. The unattended dog moved around the seats and inadvertently triggered the weapon, firing through the car and hitting the woman, who stood several yards away near a traffic signal. The injured woman was hospitalized with minor wounds. No other injuries occurred during the incident. Authorities have not disclosed the dog's breed or potential charges against the owner as the investigation continues. Interesting how there's no mention of the breed. Perhaps this isn't a dog at all, but a well-trained assassin in disguise. This could make an interesting movie.
You'd better watch out for the Hitman from MGM.
And let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? One of my favorite people, writer Bart King, is back on the show. We've had him on several times over the years. He has a new book out that is right up my alley. It's called Father Humor, Mastering the Art of the Dad Joke. Once again, Bart joins us from Portland, Oregon, via Riverside.com. Hi, Bart.
Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again. How did this book come to be, and what makes your book different? Because there are a lot of dad joke books out there.
There are too many, in my opinion, and this is no knock on the, I hate to call it competition, but the competing titles. A publisher approached me and asked if I would be interested in doing a book like this. And I said, well, yes, but I would need to do it my way. And so the way that I approached it was not to simply have a gag book, but to sort of talk about meta aspects of dad jokes and humor in general, and also sort of the history of dad jokes. The term, I should mention, speaking of history, the term dad joke was not used in common parlance until 1987, when a journalist in Cleveland kind of coined the term. Surprisingly, we never called them dad jokes before that. They were just called corny jokes, right? Or just sort of like innocent humor. And so this idea of this genre that's been devoted to it, and it's turned into kind of a thing, right? You know full well, like, you're a master of dad jokes on many platforms, and now they're just so well known we kind of take it as this secondhand lingo, but it's a relatively recent phenomenon. And so what I wanted to do was go back in time. And so, you know, we had been talking a little bit, Peter, before we went on the air, about old people. And speaking of old people, like, I certainly know from my childhood that the idea of an older gentleman or woman cornering me and telling me a funny, quote, in quotes, sometimes funny joke was well known to me. But I was asked to write an article about this topic recently by AARP, which is the American equivalent of C-A-R-P, so ARP and CARP. I do like the idea of CARP, by the way, because it sounds like something an old person would do, sort of CARP about current events or something. And so the editor sort of challenged me and said, well, can you give us some examples of dad jokes from ancient times? And there's no shortage of these, right? So I'll just share, if it's not too boring, briefly. There's a joke book that was written about 1600 years ago. It's titled The Jests of Hierocles and Phaeagrius. It is the oldest known joke book that we're aware of. One of the jokes, in fact, if you look it up on Gutenberg.com, you'll see it listed as joke number 148. The joke proceeds like this. A lot of these are sort of little dialogues. And so the joke is, a customer goes into a chatty barber's shop. The barber asks the customer, "How do you like your haircut?" The customer replies, "In silence." That joke is 1600 plus years old. And so this is the kind of thing that I was interested in sharing. Now, not all of the ancient jokes are thigh slappers like that one is, or maybe face slappers, pate slappers. But it's of interest, right? And seeing the evolution of what is funny and also sort of defining the parameters of what a dad joke even is, right? So that's kind of the way it got started. I was approached with a concept and I said, well, if I can kind of do it my way, then I'm into it. And so what I think distinguishes my book is that it's a little more of a scholarly look, but it's also fun. Like it's not simply a joke book. I realize even as I say this that I sound hopelessly supercilious. So I'm going to stop. Please interrupt me with a question, or please save me with a question.
Well, I do have a question, and that is what we now call dad jokes. As you said earlier, they're kind of corny, but the one you just said, which went back thousands of years or of millennia, it's kind of antagonistic.
It is a little squirmy, I agree, in that respect. I chose that one deliberately because a lot of the jokes in that joke, well, probably half of the jokes in the particular joke book that I just referenced are what we would call double entendres or just bawdy, B-A-W-D-Y, humor. And then the other half kind of fall into the category of what we would call, they're G-rated, and then they sort of vary between ones that don't really ring as funny anymore and ones like that that are G-rated, but there is an elbow throw there, right? You know, nowadays, I think the modern equivalent of that joke, the how do I like my haircut in silence, would be something like a kid saying, hey, I need a haircut. And then a parent says, well, really, you should get them all cut. This is still making fun. There's sort of a fun with wordplay there. It is arguably something that's still slightly mocking the person listening, but it's also sort of like what we think of as that sad trombone sound or the ba-doom-ba sound there. The joke is in and of itself the point. It's not necessarily antagonistic, like, as you astutely point out, the ancient joke was. And so that's a big part of it, right? So along these lines then, so here's a Q&A. Here's kind of a question-answer joke. It's sort of G-rated, but it's not a dad joke. So the question would be, so we pose the question, where would we be without humor is the setup. And the answer is Germany. It's a good joke. It's very funny. Anyone who's been to Germany or knows about German history or knows about the German culture gets it. But it's not a dad joke because although it doesn't transcend the bounds of like taste, it's still, there's an elbow throw there. That's also, I think a German would be most likely to smirk at that. But if it were a joke that did not have a victim, so to speak, whether it was a culture, a nation, a person, then it might qualify. And so dad jokes are just generally, they're inoffensive. They are not sarcastic. They typically are innocent, right? And sort of jolly and wholesome. Wordplay is often, more often than not, involved. They don't have to be puns, but they frequently are. They're just not mean-spirited, right? This is the modern, kind of my modern take on it. But I'm hardly the last word. But, you know, if double entendres cannot be dad jokes, then dad jokes cannot be punographic, right? Like, so that kind of eliminates like a whole field of things there. So it's sort of a combination of what is a dad joke and also what isn't it, like what disqualifies it.
Well, you know, if I were asked, where would you go to find absolutely no humor,
yeah,
I would say my parents' place.
Where would be we without humor? Moms. Yeah, that's really funny. And you know what's funny too is we can see that in our home environments. And so you asked how this book came to be. I would never have been asked to write the book in the first place if I hadn't shown signs of a sense of humor in some form right beforehand. And so really my parents and my home environment is responsible for that. Of my two parents, my mom is very funny. But she is very much like, her comments are cutting and funny, and they're often kind of like based in character as opposed to based in a transcript of what she's saying, right? So she's funny, but not on paper. You kind of have to be there. My father, on the other hand, was very much what we would think of as a dad joker now. And so his influence on me, I think, would be, it was a gender normative situation in this sense, and that they're called dad jokes, by the way, which I should just say, because I haven't. I encourage anyone and everyone to make dad jokes regardless of their gender identity, their age, their family circumstances. You know, it's all to the good. None of that matters. It's just sort of like branding happened with it, right? It happened in 1987 and it's stuck. Moms are delivering fresh chuckles every day. There's no question.
Well, you said that you came from a humorous family. And again, you know that the painting American Gothic.
Yes. Yeah.
People assume that that's a husband and wife,
right,
when in reality it is a father and a daughter.
It's just extraordinary, isn't it?
Let's assume that it was a husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
My parents would be the black version of American Gothic. I mean, that's how they took every picture.
That's extraordinary, because what goes to explain your so funny and playful way of looking at the world? Like, how did that come to be? I realize now I'm asking you questions, but if you'll indulge me.
It skips a generation. My maternal grandmother,
yeah,
was a hoot.
Got it. So humor, yeah, it's a recessive gene or something.
Exactly.
That's really, that's terrific. I do remember, you know, so for me, I was not in a humor-free household, but there were nine kids in the family. So it was a competitive household. And my parents and their progeny were into sports generally. So there was kind of a built-in competition going on a lot. And the phrase, "you win," came up a lot in conversation and reality. There were a lot of games, like literal games, like board games or card games. There was a lot of gaming going on, and this idea of winners and losers was happening a lot. So in that respect, I think that's probably part of it too, right? Because we know that humor can be competitive. I sort of dislike that now as an adult, and have for a while, like where you can see or you can feel yourself being drawn into situations where you're trying to one-up somebody, it feels like, or and you could choose to sort of absolve yourself from the situation or not. But yeah, I think that's part of it with me. And I don't know, like in your case, so it skipped a generation. And then did you sort of develop, like, you were funny, you were a funny kid. But maybe was it competitive in that you had a number of, like you had a, how do I say this? You had a woman heavy household that you grew up in. Is that accurate?
Yeah, but I was 13 years behind the pack. So I often tell people that I had four sisters, but in reality, I had five mothers.
That's great. That's not a dad joke exactly, because it's so good. Like, that transcends the dad jokiness, certainly. And that's just a great line. Thank you for that.
We're just about out of time, but I want to get to one point, because you have a dad joke hall of fame, and it includes Abraham Lincoln. Tell us about Abraham Lincoln, if you can, in about a minute.
Sure. Well, he loved tall tales. He loved jokes. He loved puns. There's many tales of Abraham Lincoln cracking a joke or a jibe. Probably my favorite one, and this probably will take me 40 seconds, was the fact that he did not attend college. Used that to his advantage. He said, "I'm a man of the people." Lincoln did debate Stephen Douglas famously, and a number of debates. One took place in Galesburg, Illinois, at a place called Knox College, which is still there today. The year was 1858. It was very windy, and so to shield the two debaters from gusts, a stage was built between two of the campus buildings. To get to the stage, both debaters, Douglas and Lincoln, had to climb through first floor windows. So Lincoln climbs through the window onto the stage. He looks out at the crowd and he says to them, "Well, at last I have gone through college." But I mean, it's a matter of record that he said it. Like, some, there's tall tales, and then there's like, well, reporters wrote down immediately what he said. So he just was a man of great intellect and great wit too. And he's just probably, certainly, in my opinion, the funniest of the presidents. Wittingly, he was wittingly funny, right? Like George W. Bush was very funny too. And I'm not ripping on George W. Bush, but he was virtually, his best lines were ones that he may have regretted later.
Well, it's a great idea for a book, not only just the fact that you have humor within the book, but you also give a little historical bend to the humor that is in the book. So it's a great book. It's called Father Humor, Mastering the Art of the Dad Joke. Thank you very much, Bart, once again for being on the program with us.
Absolute pleasure. Peter, thank you so much for having me on.
Bart King, author of Father Humor, Mastering the Art of the Dad Joke. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0876, and you'll find links to Bart's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
And now, Dad Joke Theater.
What's the one place you shouldn't take a dog? The flea market!
Join us again for another Stuff File program, Dad Joke Theater.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
I'm standing and cheering for Canada. Hi, this is Chantal Kraviazic. It's not our way to boast, but Canadians are standing strong from coast to coast to coast to protect Canadian jobs and support Canadian businesses for this country that only us command. Shop as if your country depends on it. Keep your money in Canada for Canada.
It's garbage day. You're out enjoying your daily walk when you come upon two children rummaging through a recycling bin. One of them catches your eye. You look away. Are you empathetic or apathetic? Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
Available on Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and just about every other way you stream audio. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's everywhere you want to be. And some places you don't.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Antique. Plus, Stuart Nolman will be in with another edition of Book Banter. There's a Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner coming your way, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day, and much more in Stuff File News right here, right now. A Florida influencer's traffic stop went viral after a Palm Beach County deputy cited her for holding a cell phone with her right hand while driving. Adaptive athlete Katie Thomas doesn't have a right hand. She's known on Instagram as slightly off balance, and she shared body cam footage from the February stop that showed her raising her right arm, which ends shortly after the elbow, when questioned by the officer. The deputy had claimed he observed Katie using a phone with her right hand while driving. Here's just part of that awkward exchange via body cam audio.
I said my right hand.
Well, I thought I saw you with your right hand.
You so got a hand out.
The right hand. I saw you manipulate.
So you didn't.
With the right hand, perhaps not, right?
But you, I saw you. You didn't see me with my right hand.
Okay, so are you saying
that you saw me with my right hand?
I know what I just said. I'm asking you now. Did you have your phone on your hand?
I did not.
You did not have your phone on your hand?
I did not.
Hand to God, you didn't have your phone on your hand.
Hand to God.
The other hand to God, you didn't have your phone on your hand.
Hand to God.
The officer keeps asking Katie to raise her hand to God while swearing she told the truth. She clearly raises a stump. Katie received a $116 distracted driving citation and entered a not guilty plea, but the citation was dismissed at the deputy's request before the scheduled court hearing. Well, I guess he was worried about becoming a doofus on social media. Well, pal, thanks to your body cam, too late.
The Stuff File program presents asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
A standard bottle of wine is 3 inches in diameter at its base and just shy of 12 inches tall. It holds 750 milliliters of liquid and weighs more than 2.5 pounds. Why am I telling you this? Well, while being processed into jail, a Michigan woman was found to have concealed a stolen, unopened bottle of Cupcake Vineyards Pinot Grigio wine inside her vagina. Investigators charged her with attempting to smuggle contraband into a penal institution. According to police, 48-year-old Monique Megchani was arrested earlier this month for trespassing at a CVS pharmacy in Grand Traverse. Megchani, who had previously been barred from the store, appeared at the business on May the 9th and allegedly stole wine, which she consumed in the store's bathroom. After being hospitalized due to her high intoxication, Megchani was discharged from the local medical center and immediately returned to the CVS on May the 10th. Police arrested Megchani at the checkout counter for trespassing again. At the time, the arresting officer was unaware that Megchani stole another bottle of Cupcake Pinot Grigio and hit it. Megchani was handcuffed, checked for weapons, and put into a squad car. However, that process was not smooth. During this time, Megchani advised that she was unable to get into the vehicle. After some convincing, she slowly maneuvered herself into the back seat. As she was subsequently being booked into the county jail, a female corrections deputy conducted a final check of Megchani's person. It was learned that she had concealed a bottle of Cupcake Vineyards Pinot Grigio inside her person. The screw-top container was removed and was still intact. The evidence was destroyed due to biohazard concerns. Charged with a prison contraband felony and a misdemeanor trespass count, Megchani also faces a probation violation charge related to her conviction last year for retail fraud. According to her LinkedIn profile, Megchani has worked as an associate counselor at a substance abuse treatment center where she assists clients through the critical stages of detox for illicit drugs and alcohol abuse. The science of osmosis. Pickled from the inside.
This has been the Stuff File program, asinine situations that make you want to scream into a pillow.
And now, this.
The Stuff File presents Sir Dudley Piddley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe's Poetry Corner.
I bought a new Hoover today. Plugged it in the usual way. Switched it on. What a din. It sucked everything in. Now I'm homeless with no place to stay.
And let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Seth Panich is an actor, playwright, and a professor of theater. He has also added author to his title with the release of his first novel entitled Antique. He joins us from Tuscaloosa, Alabama via Riverside.com. Hi, Seth.
Hey there. How are you today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. You have done so much in your life in the arts, including theater. But what I want to know is, why did you wait so late to write a book?
Well, better late than never, right? It's funny because I went into acting. One of the reasons I went into acting in college was because one of the 120 majors that I carried through college was creative writing. And I thought that acting training would help my dialogue work. The problem is doors opened for me as an actor and actually applied to grad school in classical acting. And got into the program of my dreams with the teacher of my dreams. And so I just kept going. Doors opened. I was able to do Shakespeare festivals. And then my first play got picked up in New York by a great producer. Her name was Lily Turner. She actually founded the Off-Broadway movement in the 40s and 50s at the Village Gate and Cricket. And so these fabulous experiences happened. And of course, so I went after them. It was during COVID where we all had a lot of time on our hands. I was thinking about just, where I've been and where I'm going. And I realized that there's one door that I never opened that I had always wanted to open in the first place. Actually having that time on my hand in between classes, you're staring at a darn screen. With all that dead time, I thought, I'm going to try it. I waited because just all these other doors opened and there were beautiful things behind those doors. And I don't regret a single moment doing it because I think that my writing has the advantage of my acting training, my directing, my playwriting, my filmmaking, all that stuff has come into my technique. It's been a while, but I'm here to stay.
So in the book Antique, when you started writing this, and you were over 50 when you started writing this, right?
Correct.
But it's a dream that you had from days gone by. So is the original story Antique, is it something that you had envisioned through the years? Or when you started writing, you decided that's the story?
Yeah, I think it sort of was a happy coincidence that both those things came at the same time. So I thought about writing a novel, and just to teach myself, I adapted a screenplay of mine as sort of like a trial novel, because I wanted to try it out first. It was definitely a trial. It was a messy thing with thorns. But at least I had the experience that I could do it, right? That I could find the time during my teaching schedule to be able to do it, and liked, the technique that I came up with writing it. But I was actually on the elliptical staving off age, and I was watching Antiques Roadshow, which is something that I just love that show. I love not necessarily Antiques, although I have a greater appreciation for them now, of course, but I love listening to people that really know their stuff. And the people on Antiques Roadshow are like walking encyclopedias. I'm just fascinated by them. And I saw this incredible episode where a man was told that this old blanket that he thought was worth nothing was worth $500,000. It was a Navajo chief's blanket. And he was crying and talking about his grandparents because he got it from them and how they were just poor farmers. And I thought, God, isn't it amazing how we still have, communities that do this for people, that like give them this sort of value. Their worth is through their objects. But isn't it sad that we need it? And that's where the idea came from. So it came right out of where I was and searching for, what my identity is going to be as I, cracking into my 50s, and what's the next step for me. I don't want to do the same thing my whole life. I've been in theater for 30 years, and so I'm looking to for the next challenge. And so all of those things kind of were the perfect storm for this book to arise.
So what is the story of Antique all about?
So do you want the 30 seconds or the 2 minutes?
I'll give you a minute. How we'll split the difference.
Okay. Okay, let's do that. So it's about a woman who's lost the answer to the question of what is it worth and what am I worth, which is what everybody asks when they go to Antiques Roadshow. And it's Grace Schaefer, and she used to be the main appraiser on Antiques Roadshow. Her husband's the host. She loves him. He loves his assistant. There's an affair. She's forced off the show. And so she's galloping a pace towards 50 without her husband, without this show. And she finds in one of these minor league Antiques Roadshow this old beaten up necklace. And what she finds is when she wears it, she can't tell people that grandma's ring is only worth $50. She starts overvaluing things because it means more to the people. And what she finds is when, instead of getting fired, when these people go to auctions, it sells for exactly the amount she says it should. So she finds herself with the power to set the price of things based on the connection that the person has with it, not what the market says. And that puts her back on track to find her holy grail, something she's been looking for her whole life, and face the ultimate question, which is, what is she worth?
Interesting. Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you're also a playwright. So how different was it from writing a play to writing a novel?
Yeah, well, certainly it takes more time, right? there's a lot more pages, so there was that sort of terror going into it. The first 20 to 30 pages were arduous for me because I was writing it as a play or as a screenplay, but I found that when I used everything together at the same time, it wasn't that much different. So I use my playwriting in terms of the dialogue, and I use my acting in terms of ideas that I could get, improvisations of what the character would do, and I use my directing ability in terms of how I want the action to progress through the pages in the mind of the reader, and my filmmaking ability in how I found perspective of how your character looks at the world that they're in, you know, the physical world, and how to bring character to that. So actually, it felt much more natural than maybe it should have. But once I sort of became a decathlete instead of, a sprinter or a long distance or middle distance, once I just let it all work at the same time, sort of in harmony, it felt quite natural.
As I said, you're a playwright, but you're also a professor of theater. Which one of those two disciplines, although they are similar, aided you more in writing antique?
I'd say the professor, because as a professor, you have to profess, right? You have to put your technique into terms that someone who doesn't understand it can understand it on a real visceral level. And that's what we're doing as writers, right? We're trying to describe something with these ink blots on a page to someone so it can flourish and blossom within them. So I think that I've been teaching now for 21 years at the university. So I think the experience of being able to put my dreams, my desires into context for someone helped me a lot when I was trying to put down into words, the world that I was seeing, in hopes that it could be a world that a reader could see.
You have written screenplays. You have written for the stage. Now that you have this novel, do you see it in any way, shape, or form in a theatrical situation?
Oh, you mean Antique as a play?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I think there are certain scenes that are very cinematic and I think could work on stage as well. There's huge auction sequences when Grace really tests her, this new power she has, just to see how far she can push it. And those happen in, very famous auction houses all the way up to Sotheby's. And that could be very dynamic on a stage. But it's very much an internal piece. So I think that would be a very different animal if it was adapted to stage. My agent would love to one day see it adapted to television, which I think it would work for episodic television, because you can get into the mind a little bit better. But I think this has been designed too much to be an internal piece. And so it would have to be completely retooled for that, I think.
Looking over your story, I see that we have something in common, and that is Charlotte's Web.
Ha! Yeah, that was, you've been in a production of it?
You were in grade 4, correct?
Yes, I was in grade 4. I played Templeton the Fat Rat, and I didn't have to pad my suit at the time.
Well, I think we have similar situations. In grade 3, I played Wilbur.
Oh, my Lord. My best friend played Wilbur. So he's the one who convinced me to audition for it. And I was a really hyperactive kid. I was ending up in the principal's office a lot, and I couldn't focus on my studies. And once I did that show with that Wilbur, all of my grades went up I never got anything under a B plus the rest of my life. So it straightened me out. What did it do for you?
Well, I didn't go into acting, but I went into broadcasting. So,
yeah. No, it's a great play, and it's such a great story for kids as well, isn't it?
It's one of my favorite books of all time. Really is.
Yeah.
So now that Antique is out, are you? Do you have the writing bug? Do you want to write more?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a writing bug as much as a writing grizzly bear. I mean, I got it big time. Before this book even released in February, I was already hard at work on my second book, which I've completed. I've done a bunch of drafts on that. It's not quite ready to show to publishers yet, but my agent and I will be doing that in September. But before I work on my final draft of that, I've started my third novel, and I'm about 40 pages into that. So it was, without a doubt, the most fulfilling creative experience that I've ever had, that first draft, because it demanded so much from all my musculature.
Are any of your subsequent books sequels, or are they standalones?
They're standalones, but I think one thing that's very similar in all of them is I'm fascinated in people that are able to hit rock bottom and climb out of that. So all the characters are doing that in different ways. And I'm also fascinated by how magic works with that and the gray line between like real human magic and some sort of extra human magic, right? So what I mean by human magic is like the touch that you get from a lover just sends something ineffable through us that I think is magical. The feeling when you look at a beautiful sunset or a beautiful work of art, whatever that is, that to me that seems superhuman. But if you really give into that, we can also go to that other side and really look at the extremities of that and how magic can arise. So there's aspects of magic in all three of my pieces, and although they are all of them are moving closer to thriller, which starts in Antique. So that's probably where I'll end up.
Well, congratulations on the book. It's entitled Antique. Will you come back on the show when your second book is published?
I would absolutely love to.
Seth, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you. Pleasure being here. Thank you so much.
Seth Panich, author of Antique. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0876, and you'll find the links to Seth's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Giving you something to think about. This is Morning Shower Thoughts.
If you drop soap on the floor, is the floor clean or the soap dirty?
Morning Shower Thoughts from the Stuff File program.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Michael Libling is the author of The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife. It's a page-turning thriller. You say you've read other serial killer novels? Oh, as Michael will tell you, not like this one.
It's not like any serial killer novel you've read before. It really goes behind the scenes. So when I say he takes a wife, you've got to imagine what it's like to be the offspring of somebody who's murdered multiple people. So how do you live with yourself after that? And you were just a kid when it all happened. If you fall in love, how do you tell the woman you love your dad was a serial killer? And how would she react? So the title, it's not entirely clear. But as you get into it, it will become very clear.
The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife. It's a recipe for mystery with a scoop of humor and a sprinkle of horror. The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife. Available now at Amazon and wherever you buy books.
Hi, this is Dan Shulman. As a baseball announcer, I'm often away from home, living out of a suitcase. A small inconvenience compared to thousands of Canadians who don't have a home and may be living out of grocery bags and old shopping carts. A life on the road is not always a choice. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
As the legend has it, the legend lives on from the Chippewa on down and the lake that they call Gitche-Gumee. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. And don't forget, Superior never gives up her dead when the gales of November come early.
Yes. I wonder what we're talking about.
On this edition of Book Banter, we're going to talk about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Not necessarily the song, but the actual story behind that famous Gordon Lightfoot song, which I first heard in the fall of 1976. I heard it on New York City Top 40 radio station. It wasn't a dark and stormy night. It was a gray, dreary, rainy Sunday afternoon as my family and me were driving along the New York State Thruway on our way home from a family affair in Long Island. When I heard the song, it sort of added to the atmosphere of Lightfoot telling the story of the tragic shipwreck through song, along with the haunting Irish-inspired folk melody. It just had me in its grip. But you know what, Peter? For years, I thought the story of the ill-fated Edmund Fitzgerald took place during the mid-19th century, you know, at a time when shipwrecks were not an uncommon occurrence, for example, like the Pequod in Moby Dick. But imagine my surprise 40 years later, during a press junket trip to Wisconsin, I came across several books about the tragedy at a souvenir shop, that it took place in 1975 and the ship in question was an industrial strength tanker whose main source of cargo was iron ore, particularly in the form of taconite, which is a pellet-shaped substance that was one-third iron and combined with clay. And that strengthened my resolve to find out more about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. It finally came in the form of John U. Bacon's thorough, absorbing book, The Gales of November. Now, Bacon has delivered a book that gives an all-encompassing look at the Edmund Fitzgerald tragedy, not only the historic and technical aspects, but most importantly, the human face to it. Now, this human face is focused upon the 29 men who made up the crew of the doomed ship. They were dedicated, honest, hardworking people who withstood the routines and hardships of the nine-month Great Lakes shipping season, who always looked forward to spending their downtimes while the ship loaded or unloaded their taconite or related cargo at their ports of call along the coasts of small towns, whether it be Wisconsin, Minnesota, Ohio, or even Cleveland. It was a 14-hour process, no matter what. And they frequented their favorite restaurants or pubs along the coast, those coastal towns, where they enthusiastically sang their unofficial anthem, Brandy by Looking Glass, or shop for gifts for their waiting loved ones. I mean, this ship was represented by a great number of hale and hearty men, like Ernest McSorley, its dedicated, much-respected captain, who was about to retire helming the ship following the 1975 season after 45 years working along the Great Lakes, or Bruce Hudson, who used part of his wages to buy a 1974 Dodge Challenger so that he and his fellow deckhand, Mark Thomas, could embark upon a much-anticipated road trip to California immediately after the ship's final journey of the year, and then return home to become a family man to his girlfriend who was expecting their first child. But also, yes, there is the Gordon Lightfoot story, his contribution to the legend of the Edmund Fitzgerald. At the time, he was working on a song for a new album, but all he had was a tune, but no lyrics or story to go with it. Then he read a half-page article about the tragedy in an issue of Newsweek magazine, and what attracted his attention was its lead paragraph. It told about how a Mariners church in Detroit paid a special tribute to the sunken ship by ringing its chimes 29 times, which represented every crew member on board the Edmund Fitzgerald during their doomed voyage along Lake Superior. It helped Lightfoot to accelerate the completion of the song. He recorded it with his band in the spring of 1976 and accomplished it in just one take. And upon its release, the six-minute ballad became a hit. It appeared on the American and Canadian charts and ended up as the number two song in Billboard's list of the top 100 songs of 1976. Number one was Tonight's the Night by Rod Stewart. And this song became one of the songs that fans would associate Lightfoot with for the remainder of his life and career. So The Gales of November is a book that will appeal to seafarers and landlubbers alike. Weaving diligent research and sharp storytelling, John U. Bacon has given a human side to this tragic shipwreck, as well as the reality and legend this ship has been attached to, especially, to quote Gordon Lightfoot, "when the gales of November come early."
Again, what's the book?
It's called The Gales of November by John U. Bacon. It's published by Live Right, and it's $47.
You know, Stuart, I know a little bit about this book only because we had Mr. Bacon on the show back in November of last year. So I'm curious to know, by the way, what other books in this genre do you suggest?
Well, while we're on the subject of Mr. Bacon, I recommend his previous book, which deals with an infamous maritime disaster. It's called The Great Halifax Explosion, about that disaster in December 1917, where two ships collided. One of them carried some of the most volatile explosives and armaments that you can imagine, and it practically obliterated the city and cost 2,000 lives. I'm going to be going to Halifax next month, so I'm going to check out how the city memorialized that disaster. And there's also a Halifax connection to the next book I recommend, which is Walter Lord's A Night to Remember, which is one of the first books dealing with the sinking of the Titanic, and which is the gold standard and set the trend for many more books that dealt with this maritime disaster of the sinking of this luxury liner in 1912.
And again, this week's book is?
It's called The Gales of November by John U. Bacon, published by Live Right, and it's $47.
And how can one find you? I'm assuming it's not at the bottom of the sea.
No, it's and not along the shores of Lake Superior, for that matter. It's you can find me in the pages of the Montreal Times. You go just to mtltimes.ca or my blog, stuartnellmansgrapevine.wordpress.com.
Thank you very much, Stu.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter, and ahoy, matey.
Stuart Nellman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now. A Florida chiropractic office has displayed humorous puns on its roadside marquee for years, rotating messages like, "We never crack under pressure," and "Our Easter adjustments are excellent." This was to amuse passing drivers. The recent sign read, "Licensed crack dealer," as a play on spinal adjustments. On May 24th, a sunny Sunday afternoon, 23-year-old Benjamin Fregali used landscaper bricks and a tree branch to destroy the display, causing over $1,000 in damage to letters, message boards, and lighting. When police arrived, Fregali spontaneously advised that the sign message was "licensed crack dealer," and he thought that was illegal. Officers noted no signs of intoxication or mental health issues. So in other words, he's just a moron. Fregali faces felony criminal mischief charges. His criminal history includes trespass, battery, and assaulting his father with a baseball bat in 2024. That story was because he allegedly punched his father in the head and hit him in the ribs with a metal baseball bat after being told to go to bed because he was intoxicated. Oh, good. So he's a moron with anger issues. Yeah. Well, clearly, alcohol seems to be his problem, so he's not the idiot of the day. But, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff I'll present, the Idiot of the Day.
Jimmy McDaniel is facing multiple charges in Grapevine, Texas, including operating a vehicle in a closed section of a park, no valid boat registration, and water safety violations. The charges stem from McDaniel's apparent test of his Tesla Cybertruck's Wade mode. He allegedly intentionally drove into Grapevine Lake, where the vehicle quickly became disabled and began taking on water. McDaniel and his passengers were able to get out, but the Grapevine Fire Department had to use a wrecker to pull the Cybertruck from the lake. McDaniel insists he's driven the Cybertruck into water before without incident, but Tesla says Wade mode is only for shallow water crossings. Well, forget the driver. Let's talk about the passengers who went along with it. What's their deal? Anyway, and Jimmy, it's a Cybertruck, not a cyber duck. Now, why, oh why, would you drive your Cybertruck into a lake with passengers to test Tesla's Wade mode? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0876. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0876. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can find me on Facebook, Spoutable, Mastodon, and Blue Sky as PA Holder. Check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including kdxradio.com and over the air on stations like
World FM New Zealand,
WNRHLPFM Newport Richey, Florida,
KZZHLPFM Eureka, California,
WFNULP St. Paul, Minnesota,
CKUWFM Winnipeg,
CFMU Hamilton,
CKLU Sudbury,
Local 107.3 FM St. John,
CHSR Fredericton.
Plus, streaming on any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm Peter's lifelong manservant, Sir Dudley Pidley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe. I was knighted by the Queen, yet I still have memories of changing Peter's nappies. And here I am, literally talking to myself in a padded room. Life is a cruel mistress.